Well, happy Thanksgiving, everyone. On this Encore show, Peter Schiff, Louis Navalier, Bill Murphy, and Harry S. Dent Jr. are our featured guests. Be sure to tune in next week for a brand new episode with the entire crew, including Robert Ian. GoldSeek.com radio begins now. It's a pleasure to welcome back Louis Navalier to the show. Navalier & Associates, he's also the editor of four leading stock advisory newsletters.
Honor to be here.
In your latest report, we finally got another retest of the low in the S&P 500. Light volume, not always a good sign. Are you sticking with that as the bottom, or do you think we might see yet another retest?
I'm glad you brought that up. You know, we have a chart that we put on our weekly market mail that shows what the market was doing in 2011 and what it's doing this year. And it's eerily similar. And if history repeats, we'll have one more retest. And one of the reasons we think that might happen is on this market rebound, we've had a low-quality rally, a short-covering rally. We've had a lot of energy stocks bounce over 15%. We've had a lot of small-cap stocks bounce dramatically. And that's a sign that the correction is being exhausted. And in the meantime, when the leadership shifted just briefly to energy and other money-losing stocks, on the short squeeze, some of the quality stocks like the healthcare, the biotechs, and the techs are going to have good earnings because they're related to Apple. We're going to hit with profit taking. So we call this opposite bill. The current rally is not going to be sustainable, and we expect, and we've seen it broaden out a little. And so that's one way it ends. But the other way is we go back and we test the lows one last time. And so one more retest is likely. The reason we say this is the third quarter row of negative sales for the S&P. But the earnings are supposed to be down well over 4%. I personally think the S&P's earnings are going to be flat because I've noticed the stock buyback activity has picked up dramatically. So we're in very, very interesting times. And I can tell everyone that if they don't like all these daily shenanigans in the market, just invest the week before Thanksgiving, because that's when the happy time of year comes. That's when we gather with friends, family, football, food, and then the market should be firming up by then. The other thing is I have to apologize that a lot of the market correction was just what we call seasonal shenanigans. People aren't around in August. Europeans are gone. The New Yorkers are gone, and they succeeded this time.
I think it's a great idea, watching the market ahead of Thanksgiving. That traditionally, I mean, if you look at the Market Timers Almanac, for those maybe who were scared out of the market, presents an interesting opportunity. Moving on to the Fed, you know, we saw the Fed sit pat at the last FOMC meeting. Take a look at the 30-day Fed funds futures. They're looking at a 94 to 95% odds of holding steady on the rates at the October meeting. Do you see a Fed rate hike before the end of 2015? And if not, when do you think they finally pull the trigger?
You know, I have to be honest with you. I was going out telling everybody that never raising rates in my lifetime. People say, how long are you going to live? And I said, well, so my oldest daughter gets married, and it was in July. So I've since changed that to say that if they do raise rates, it'll be when I go in December. I think the September payroll report was a disaster. It wasn't so much it was disappointing. It was the downward revisions for July and August. The payroll report has been revised down every month this year except for June because of the double accounting of temp jobs. Most of the jobs are created in America are part-time. When an ambitious person gets two part-time jobs, they get counted twice. Eventually, they match up the Social Security numbers and revise the numbers down. This is not me pointing this out. This is the Fed themselves in their official FOMC minutes a few years ago. And this is why they got rid of their unemployment target. That is one reason they don't want to raise rates. Another is wages actually fell in September, and they've been very weak in recent months. And Janet Yellen, who's a labor economist, made it very clear she wants to see wage growth. Finally, they want to see inflation. We actually have deflation based on the CPI. One of the problems we have with the Fed is their forecast can't hit the broad side of the barn. They were forecasting wage growth. They were forecasting inflation. It didn't show up. So they got egg on their face. And the data dependent Fed really doesn't want to raise rates. However, if they do, it'll be in December, one and done. We'll be distracted by the holidays. They don't want to raise rates next year, because if they raise rates, you know, the more they raise rates, the more they widen the wealth gap in America that will be debated endlessly in the presidential election year. So if they want to do it, they'll force it December 1 and done, and they'll probably cite market rates or market forces as the reason for that.
How does the potential for a government shutdown factor into your analysis?
It really doesn't, because John Boehner is still in charge. And even if he was going to be replaced, I realize that's in flux now, he didn't want to do the shutdown. They picked Paul Ryan. He doesn't want to do a shutdown. You know, it just depends who they pick. So, you know, they can pick anyone. Essentially, they don't have to have someone in the House. So if they pick Ted Cruz, I don't know if your senator can. But yeah, they might shut the government down. You know, there's a very feisty minority caucus that is causing all this chaos. Harry Reid helped make Congress more impotent, for lack of a better word, with the 60-vote rule. And the people in the House are mad. We'll see if they get a new leader, but in the end, I don't think anybody wants to shut down government.
In the past, you've talked about stock buybacks and, of course, corporate America selling bonds in order to finance much of that aggressive behavior. Do you see more of that ahead?
Absolutely. You know, I'm a stock guy and I have a $2 billion year bond business. Everybody wants yield. It's simple. I can get a 4.47% yield on triple B corporates, investment grade bonds that have all fees. The truth is that corporate America operates around the world, and Apple's probably the best example of this. They borrowed over in Europe for the third time in the last several months. They've sold 9-year notes at 1.4%. And then they obviously earn a lot more than 1.4. So they take all that money and buy their stock back. We've seen Biogen do this. We've seen Gilead. We've seen Alaska Airlines announce their latest buyback. They're going to buy back over 10% of their outstanding stock just on the latest buyback. The leaders of this have been Lockheed Martin, AutoZone, O'Reilly Auto Parts. And the stock market is actually dying. You know, my average large cap stock retires 6.2% of its float a year. They'll be gone in 14 years. The S&P's average stock retires almost 4% of its float. It's going to take them 22 years to disappear. So this is one of the reasons the market is going up on this light volume. It's very interesting, and it's one of the consequences of the Fed's zero interest rate policy. But the negative rates around the world are also exacerbating this situation.
That's another important part of the puzzle here, that we have coordinated efforts by central bankers around the world. Then let's use this as an opportunity to see what you're expecting in 2016. Do you see more volatility ahead, or do you see a recovery, as you point to in your latest newsletter?
We do see a recovery because the economy grew at 3.9%. The catalysts for the recovery are consumer spending and inventory rebuilding. There are soft spots in the economy like energy, but we've got some evidence that manufacturing orders are starting to soften due to China. You know, any country that supplies China is already in a recession, like in Canada, Korea, Australia, New Zealand, much of Latin America, with exception of Mexico. So what's happening is we think the U.S. will not go into recession. We are benefiting from the strong dollar shutting down commodity prices. That's putting more money in people's pockets. They feed at the gas pumps. I realize we're in the winter when the fuel costs drop, but they will go up again in the spring. So this will be fleeting, but it'll help hopefully have a good holiday season. But the other thing about America is that when we have these presidential election campaigns, you cannot become an elected president of the United States unless you're a positive person. So the candidates, for lack of a better word, are going to run around and suck up to everybody, and it usually lifts people's spirits, and it usually results in a very strong market. And then we elect somebody, and then we ask, why do we do that? That's another matter. Presidential election terms are traditionally good for the market, and I realize we have a lot of candidates now. We'll have fewer soon.
All right, and as we wrap up here, any particular equities on your radar screen?
Well, right now, I definitely like healthcare-related stocks. CVS is the new wave of healthcare. You know, you don't go to doctors to get shots anymore. You go to your drugstore, CVS, or Walgreens. CVS also does chemotherapy, not at every corner one, but they have CVS Health. It's helping with the outsourcing of healthcare. I like a lot of the retailers are spending the money, getting all the consumer spending money. One would be Darden Restaurants, that's Capital Grill. Another one would be the Home Depot's or Lowe's, the Target, the Costco's. Those are are all good examples. Southwest Airlines is another. I'm just trying to follow consumer spending. Starbucks is on the radar. They've been through low coffee prices. A lot of good things are going on right now.
Louis Navalier, we appreciate your thoughts today, and I wonder if you'd like to share any contact information, particularly with regard to your advisory newsletters.
Navalier.com is our management company site. Put our research out there free in the public domain. We want to empower people. So go to your site, empower yourself. I think you'll enjoy what you see. By the way, only 14% of the stocks out there are A-rated. So it's a very narrow market, and whether you have a predominantly A-rated stock.
Louis Navalier, thank you so much.
Take care.
Great to have you back with us at GoldSeek.com Radio. Time to open up the phone line and reach into the mailbag for listeners' questions and comments.
Hi, Chris. This is Marcus calling. I'm a longtime listener, and I wanted to thank you for the great work you do on your show. It really provides valuable insight. I wanted to let you know about a service that I use that I thought you and other listeners would be interested in. Anyone that's perhaps done some preparation at home to plan for emergency preparedness, maybe put aside some food and water, that type of thing. There's a group of ex-military men, Green Berets, who are really quite exceptional, and they've developed a consulting firm called the Yarborough Group. They'll come into your house and interview you and your family, basically give you a grade in terms of what kind of preparations you've done and if they're adequate or not. They can help you with everything from a fire evacuation plan for you and your children to a survival plan in case communications go down and you need to meet up so that you have a plan in place. So I really think it's an invaluable service. They can be reached at yarboroughgroup.com. It's yarboroughgh-group.com. Thanks, Chris.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
James Turk, founder of GoldMoney.com, author of The Coming Collapse of the Dollar and How to Profit from It.
Yeah, hi, Chris. Good to be with you.
Start off today with the dollar rally. Since we last talked, it continued even higher. Quite a remarkable rally over a nine-month period, erasing 12 years of losses. But some of our guests here on the show are convinced that this is just a final hurrah, if you will, before an ultimate day of reckoning for the greenback. Any thoughts on what that might mean for investors?
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, the fundamental underlying factors for the dollar have not really changed for the better. There's still too much debt. There's still too much government spending. What we've seen is that with interest rates in Europe moving below zero, interest rates in the United States that are still basically above zero make the dollar look like a good alternative. So in that sense, it's an emotional knee-jerk reaction, hot money moving into the dollar and driving it higher relative to the euro and some of the other currencies that have negative interest rates. But, you know, underlying factors still suggest that the U.S. hasn't come to grips with its basic problems. You know, too much government spending, too much debt, too much printing by the money printing by the Federal Reserve. It's causing, you know, problems for the dollar, and, you know, eventually those dollars will be, those problems will be realized.
Exactly. It just seems to be the least bad alternative, I guess, around, and money flowing in. It really props up our equities and bond markets. But probably if we saw the big picture, maybe a chart of all the currencies in the world, the long-term downtrend in fiat money would be evident. Don't you suspect?
Yeah, clearly. And in fact, if you look at gold versus all of the major currencies of the world, you know, gold is basically up against all of them with the exception of the U.S. dollar, where it's, you know, down a little bit. But, you know, gold is up 10% this year against the euro, for example.
Since you're closer than the rest of us, or most of us here, to the eurozone drama, the Grexit and so many of the issues facing or plaguing the region, do you see this eventually escalating?
Yeah, you know, there's no doubt there are people looking for safe havens. You see it in a lot of different places, a lot of different ways. Housing prices in London, Singapore, and other safe havens are rising. A lot of money is going into collectibles and other forms of tangibles. And money's coming out of a weak spot. There's been a decline in bank deposits in Greece, for example. That money's been coming out of Greece and looking for safe havens. And as a consequence of, you know, these monetary problems that we have in Europe, you know, again, similar to the problems in the United States, over-leveraged governments, too much government spending, not enough wealth creation to service all of these debt obligations, it's going to come to a head. You know, when it's going to happen is always difficult to get an exact timing. But so many trends coming together now, Chris, to me, it seems like you can see a lot of volatility coming, you know, pretty soon.
You mentioned recently that the European Central Bank will expropriate deposits in Greek bank accounts to help cover those loans that the bank has made to their government. And I wonder if you could give us an idea of how this aspect of the story could impact the markets.
The European Central Bank did that in Cyprus. They've said that's going to be the blueprint for other countries in Europe that get into trouble. And, you know, Greece is clearly into trouble. So we will see if the European Central Bank will repeat the Cyprus experience again and take away bank deposits from bank depositors after the Greek or after the, you know, the government nationalizes the banks in that country. What it's basically doing, you know, these types of events is they undermine confidence in fiat currency. And fiat currency rests on nothing but confidence. If that confidence disappears, you end up getting what's called a flight from the currency. You know, the demand for that currency declines because of the perceived problems or the monetary illnesses that are affecting that currency. And as a consequence, it loses purchasing power. And it tends to happen over a fairly short period of time, as we've seen really just over the past several months with regard to the euro and how much it's dropped compared to the dollar and even some of the non-euro European currencies like the British pound.
An interesting article from Zero Hedge noted that the New York Fed stockpile of the yellow metal actually dropped below 6,000 tons for the first time in over 100 years. Could the New York Fed and some of its compatriots attempt to manipulate the markets by selling off their stockpile?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is indeed the case. You know, you can keep a lid on the gold price for a certain extent. We saw how this happened in the 1960s, for example, during the London gold pool, where this cartel of central banks got together to keep the gold price at $35 an ounce, even though the market knew that gold was worth more than $35 an ounce. So basically, that was forcing the central banks to keep feeding physical metal into the market at that $35 an ounce price, to try to keep that lid on it. But eventually, the central banks had enough. They threw in the towel and they let the gold price rise. It's basically the same thing this time around, though obviously at a much higher price. Metals coming out of the Federal Reserve in New York as an indication of how tight physical gold is here in London. And there's no doubt in my mind that the metal is coming out of New York in order to help satisfy the strong physical demand for metal that we're seeing pretty much all over the world, but particularly in Asia, which continues to acquire, you know, huge amounts of physical metal. And, you know, China particularly has become now the largest buyer of physical metal, you know, every year.
Ambrose Evans Pritchard published, I thought, a rather interesting article that the U.S. might be making a huge blunder by treating China, our neighbor, as an economic foe, at least allegedly importing a huge, many, many tons per day of gold. And it seems as though we might be setting ourselves up for just a strategic error here. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I do agree that it is a strategic error. You know, China is, depending on who you're measuring, who's measuring it and what time of the week it's being measured, China is either the largest or the second largest economy in the world. It's looking for stature. It's looking for respect in the community of nations. And it's looking for ways to exercise its power. And it's being thwarted of doing that within institutions created by the United States after the Second World War, like the IMF, World Bank, and things like that. So it's not surprising that China is out there creating its own institutions, most recently being the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, AIIB, where the U.S. was saying to its allies, you know, don't join it because America wanted to keep its influence in the prime position. But, you know, everybody's recognized the writing on the wall that there's a lot of economic activity, a lot of growth potential in China, and a lot of nations around the world have joined that AIIB, despite the fact that the U.S. had asked them not to. You know, as the dominant monetary power after the Second World War, you know, under what's called the Bretton Woods Agreement, and thereafter under this floating currency regime that governments have been following, the U.S. government has this responsibility to the rest of the world to maintain a currency that can be used effectively in international trade. And it's a currency that, like the British pound under the classical gold standard when the British Empire was reigning supreme, it would have, it would preserve purchasing power and could be used under a constant rule of law as a neutral tool in commerce. Well, the U.S. government has moved away from that in recent decades and now is using the dollar more as a political weapon rather than a neutral, allowing it to circulate as a neutral tool in commerce. And they're also looking at domestic political considerations rather than geopolitical and geo-monetary situations when from the dollar's role internationally. And that's causing a lot of feedback, and it's impairing the dollar's role. And that ultimately, I think, will decrease the demand for the dollar, and I think is likely to be one of the reasons why the dollar will be heading south as we move toward the end of this year.
Add to your comments, your earlier comments regarding China's appetite for the yellow metal. India is now trying desperately to compete with China's voracious appetite, according to Bullion Star, exploding imports. The race seems to be on to insulate from what they probably perceive as profligacy on an epic scale.
Yeah, well, I think this is going to be an interesting year as we move toward the end of the year. We have a lot of events coming up over the next several months, particularly September, October, November, when the IMF is meeting to determine the reweighting of the special drawing right, the SDR. And we'll see whether or not China is included in the new reweighting of the SDR. If it's not included or if China's not happy with the way it's been treated, I think that could have a profound effect on the global monetary system, which I'm basically thinking would be very bullish for gold and very negative for the U.S. dollar.
If you could tell folks a bit more about GoldMoney.com.
Yeah, I'm the founder of Gold Money. We're an online company, GoldMoney.com. Very convenient, economical, and safe way to buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and to have that metal stored for you in a number of different vaults around the world to give you a geographic diversification of your precious metal portfolio.
Very good. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chris.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KI
KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, Mr. John Williams, head of ShadowStats, an alternative economic resource that's widely acclaimed by many of the folks in the gold community, in the mainline media.
Thanks for having me, Chris. We've had some extraordinary distortions in the markets in the last year, particularly since June of 2014. At that point in time, because of the situation in the Ukraine, we saw some actions taken by the U.S., some overtly against the Russian leaders and covertly in the area of trying to knock down oil prices and strengthen the dollar in an effort to create financial stress for Russia. And we were successful in doing that, but that threw off a lot of factors from what I would have expected. Very simply, where the dollar was played up, where the markets picked up on it, was very much along the lines of the U.S. economy's booming along now, and the Federal Reserve's going to take a more normal monetary policy. They'll start raising interest rates, and all that was used to help rally the dollar. Problem is, the economy never recovered from the big downturn that we had started in 2007 into 2008 into 2009. Worst contraction since the Great Depression. That's official. I'll contend, though, that we did not recover, as the official numbers show, starting in the middle of 2009. You go by the official GDP numbers, the broadest measure that the government publishes on the economy. Mid-2009, the economy began recovering, and by early 2011 had exceeded where it was before the recession, just continued growing ever since. You don't see that in any other series. And I'll contend that the underlying reality has been one of a plunge into 2008, 2009, and then basically a period of protracted stagnation. There have been some series that have started to climb, but they have not recovered. So coming into the end of this last year, all of a sudden we're seeing booming GDP reporting, the strongest economic growth in over a decade, which again was not the common experience. You have pockets of weakness and strength, but largely weakness still around the country. What's kept all of this from really becoming a boom, as I'm sure everyone would like to see, has been the consumer. Consumer generally has been strapped for liquidity. Income is not growing, net of inflation. That credit's tough to come by. That's one way you could get beyond not having real growth in income, inflation-adjusted income. Consumer confidence. You hear all the headlines here about how it's recovered, but still, historically, it's at levels that you normally see in a recession. We don't have a recovery with the consumer. If a consumer doesn't have real growth in income, I'm talking here adjusted for inflation, there's no way you can have sustained growth in consumption, again, shy of the debt growth, which is also restricted at this point. And that's more than 70% of the economy. It's also hitting still the housing market. So all these numbers that we saw last year, towards the end of the year, were just nonsense in terms of what was being reported. There are a number of ways or a number of things that explain that. What you could have expected, indeed what happened, even the official numbers started to turn down in the last several months, enough so that market sentiment is beginning to shift towards the economy certainly being weak in the first quarter. It certainly has been so far in terms of the reporting, and I've been contending that would happen. But even more so that this will be the onset of what will be recognized as a new recession. That's not a circumstance in which the Fed is going to continue to ease, continue to tighten, to move away from easing. And it's the expectation that the Fed would tighten that has probably been the biggest factor behind the strength in the U.S. dollar in the global markets. That and the expectations of continued economic growth. These economies slowed. We've seen expectations being shifted on the Fed. You've seen some weakness in the dollar. We still have a long ways to go before we get back to where we were last June. But some in substance, I think the corner's been turned and turned in terms of the mania that we almost had coming into the this year. Again, as the dollar strengthened, it tended to also weaken gold and silver. As we see the economy turn into recession, which still is not broadly anticipated, you'll find the pattern here will accelerate. You'll see greater downturn in the dollar, which in turn will be more inflationary, tend to push oil prices back up. It'll pressure gold and silver prices to the upside. And it's the reversal of what I would refer to as a market craziness of the last 8 months or so that we have ahead of us in the next several months. So that I would see that generally as a time where you're going to see some recovery in the price of gold, and as a circumstance for the Fed that is just impossible, because what happened here with the central banks, not just the Fed, but the rest of the world, but the Fed leading the pack, was that in the crisis of 2008, the panic of 2008, they were faced with a collapse of the banking system, and they did everything, anything they had to do to keep the system from collapsing. The problem, they did nothing that fundamentally improved things. All they did was they pushed the problems into the future. And now we're in that future. They don't have the options they had back in 2008. It's going to get very difficult. I look for still a panic decline here in the dollar that will be coming along. I can't tell you just when it's going to happen. The timing in something like a panic is somewhat irrational in nature, but everything's in place. And as the more of a sell-off you see in the dollar, the more of a pickup you're going to see in domestic inflation. And that in turn is going to become a runaway inflation as the rest of the world begins to not just sell the dollar, but to dump the dollar. Again, this is in the context of all that's happened since 2008. The crisis ahead is going to be extremely difficult, going to lead to very high inflation and hyperinflation down the road here, so that it's an environment where the individual needs to look at preserving his or her wealth and assets in terms of purchasing power. The best bet on that is holding physical gold and silver that provides you with a store of wealth that rides through the difficult times. And as you come out on the other side, it also is liquid and will tend to preserve the purchasing power of the assets that were put into the gold and the silver.
You know, this idea of inflation, deflation, there's considerable debate. It seems like every time the dollar goes up and commodities sag, the deflationists win the argument, and when the contrary happens, vice versa. What they're interpreting to be deflation might just be disinflation or slowing of the inflation rate temporarily.
Look back at the money supply and the... You get into the notional value of the derivatives. It's pretty difficult to put a hard number as to how it would play out, because the normally the exposures are a lot smaller than the notional value. You have a system where the government could intervene and basically freeze the system and prevent some of the collapse that would come with that if you had major defaults, which would then expose people to the notional value in terms of a liability or conceivably an asset. I don't see that. I mean, there are going to be a lot of problems here, but the big issue is going to be the collapse in the dollar. And with that, as the dollar becomes worthless, the rest of it doesn't make much difference, because there's no a hyperinflation. What might be worth $1 trillion today could be in terms of purchasing power worth $100.
What about for our listeners who might be scratching their heads saying, but haven't we just seen the greenback erase losses in the blink of an eye? That would seem to indicate underlying strength. You view this as an anomaly then?
Well, it's a canard. The dollar has been in general decline and to a certain extent a matter of a direct policy of the U.S. government and the Federal Reserve over decades. I mean, if you go back to 1970, I think you'll find that the dollar has lost in excess of 90% of its value against the Swiss franc, for example. We have seen some rally all since June of last year. Otherwise, we're pretty much at all-time lows, and that took us to multi-year highs. But I think that was largely an artifact of what was being done to try and damage the Soviets and maybe trying, not the Soviets, Russia, at the same time perhaps trying to give some troubled European systems a little bit of a...
Peter Schiff, chairman of Schiff Gold, located at schiffgold.com, author of several bestsellers and a radio host. Welcome back, Peter Schiff.
Thanks for having me back on. It's a good day to be talking gold.
It is a good day, isn't it? And you know, one top market watcher recently in the blogosphere is calling for gold as high as $1,400 an ounce, citing all different factors, including the Denmark Saxo Bank, which is saying they're seeing a change in sentiment and that a floor in the gold metal appears to be in place. What do you think?
Well, it looks pretty compelling. You know, the recent pullback to around 1150, which was support, which was resistance rather for a while, as gold was kind of trading between 1100 and 1140-ish. When we tried to get back down below 1150, they couldn't push it down the other day. We're now trading closer to 1180. Last I looked, it's just over 1177. This is the highest gold has been in a few months. Silver now decisively above the $16 level. That's a little breakout. The dollar is breaking down as gold is breaking out. We're continuing to get bombarded with negative economic news. The trifecta again today. And in fact, the Walmart news, I think, is a lot worse than it's being portrayed. I mean, this stock is collapsing. It's at a four-year low. Stock's down 33% from its 52-week high. This is America's biggest retailer. This is a company that benefits most from a strong dollar and cheap oil prices, yet it can't survive in this phony recovery. We are headed back to recession. I mean, I dare the Fed to raise interest rates. I mean, it's so ridiculous that people still believe their bluff. But the question is, how much longer is the Fed going to get away with pretending that they're about to raise interest rates and actually fessing up that their real plan is QE4? And you talk about $1,400 gold. That's nothing compared to where gold's going to go when people figure out that the Fed has been lying the whole time.
Yeah, no, I think the Walmart situation, you know, the CEO cites excessive wages as a primary cause for their stock drop.
Remember, they just bowed down to a lot of pressure to raise their wages. And so this is going to be a very hollow victory for the left, right? Because they hate all the low-paying Walmart jobs. So now Walmart's going to eliminate a lot of those low-paying jobs. But that just means we're going to have a lot more unemployed people. Because now that their profits are plunging, the layoffs are going to have to begin.
Okay, very good. Let's move on to the Federal Reserve. They're not in any hurry to raise rates this year. And it doesn't look like they're so anxious to raise rates as soon as early next year.
They can't raise rates. I mean, not unless they're willing to prick their own bubble, which they're clearly not. So the whole game the Fed has been playing is to pretend they were going to raise rates so they can pretend the economy was strong enough to withstand the higher rates, but knowing the entire time they couldn't do it, which is why they never did. The question is, when are people going to figure this thing out? You know, and is the Fed going to get away with pretending that they called off the rate increases because the weakness in the overseas economies unexpectedly spilled over to us? Because that's going to be their excuse, but that's not the reason. The reason they didn't raise rates is because they never intended to raise them in the first place. They're talking about bringing them to a negative below zero.
I mean, there is a lot of talk across the board in central banks around the world that we could see negative rates, which we already saw briefly in the Eurozone.
You know, the Great Recession started with interest rates at 5%. So, you know, they had plenty of room to lower them before they did QE. But if this greater recession is about to start and rates are at zero at the beginning, well, then what's the encore, right? What are they going to do? So, I mean, negative rates might be the only thing that they could think of.
tight supply conditions in the precious metals. I mean, we're reading there's an unprecedentedly low amount of silver bullion around, forcing some mints to even ration sales, increase over time, and send U.S. buyers around the world to, you know, new locations and whatnot online just to get their orders filled. For instance, the U.S. Mint setting weekly sales quotas for its American Silver Eagle. That is becoming the norm now. The Canadian Mint is also following suit, as well as the Australian Perth Mint, which sold a record of 2.5 million ounces this month alone.
You know, there's real demand out there for precious metals. I mean, you have to separate the speculative demand from the hedge fund community and the highly leveraged traders who really are just making bets and just are, you know, trying to play around with other people's money. And then you've got the real buyers. Like our clients at Shift Gold, who buy gold and silver, they put it away. I mean, they're not buying it to speculate on what it's going to be worth next week or next month. They want to protect their long-term purchasing power. And those buyers are around all over the world. I mean, there are people all around the world that don't trust paper money for good reason, and rather than putting their money in a bank and getting no interest and risking a bail-in or something, they take their money and they turn it into gold or silver and they hold on to it. And as more and more people want to do this, we're running out of physical supply. You know, what's really going to cause the market to skyrocket is when the speculators decide that they want to buy back the silver and gold that they sold that they don't even own. And this is when you're going to see an explosion to the upside. Right now, the speculators are keeping a lid on prices, and that's a great deal for the real investors who want to buy. But the problem is we're running out of actual gold and silver for people to buy, because the stuff that they're selling on Wall Street, my clients can't take delivery of that. That's just on paper. They want the real stuff. That has to come out of a mine. They have to take it out of the ground. They have to fabricate it. They have to ship it. This shows you where the real market is headed as opposed to where the speculators think it's headed. But once the speculators figure out they got it wrong, look out. Right, this is going to be an explosive move up.
No, exactly. I think there's another component to this story. Sure, we've got the speculation, but then on the other side, there's the wealth preservation aspects. And this has sort of been, I think, tossed into the corner over the last 6-7 years during this record equities rally in the housing, the echo bubble, if you will, recovery. What happens when that fear re-enters the precious metals markets?
People have been fearful of higher interest rates. They've been fearful of a strong dollar. And that, you know, is scared people out of the gold market. Wait till they realize that what they really have to fear is quantitative easing for more 0% interest rates. That's what's going to happen. Walmart stock is down 33% from its 52-week high. I mean, that is a huge move. I mean, we go down another 20%, this stock is lower than it was 10 years ago. This is the nation's biggest retailer. And if our economy is driven by consumer spending, and consumers do most of their spending at Walmart, and Walmart is collapsing,
it doesn't look like there's a black swan on the horizon. You know, I see a whole flock of black swans looking for a place to land. You know, doesn't that really summarize just how integral gold and silver are going to be to every investor's portfolio?
Yeah, and the most ironic thing about it is how few people own any gold at all. You know, even when you talk about it, I mean, I talk about people having 5 to 10% in gold, and they look at me like, why? Just even having any. To me, I mean, I'd rather have all my money in gold than none of my money in gold. But, you know, to advocate having gold as part of a portfolio, but, you know, what's comforting is the smartest people in the world are saying the same thing. You know, yet they feel perfectly confident owning U.S. treasuries or junk bonds or inflated, social media stocks.
The Argentine peso revalued something like close to 100-120% against gold in the blink of an eye. Very similar thing occurred, you know, with the ruble recently. You add that up. But then, you know, we still haven't touched on another, I think, important aspect that just doesn't get any play because it doesn't seem very relevant, I think, in this modern interconnected world. There is some interesting legislation that's gone on the books in North America as well as in the EU that indicates that your dollars, as soon as you send them into any lending or financial institution, are no longer yours. They're rehypothecated, whether you've signed off on that or not, or whether you've read the fine print or not. It's no longer your funds, it's their funds, to do with what they want to. According to this latest article, SHTF.com, That could indicate that the FDIC no longer has any responsibility for our funds.
Oh, yeah. And look, we're very close to a breakdown in the dollar index, and this thing could free fall. Because remember, the entire bullish case for the dollar was built on the foundation of higher rates. And not just like a one and done, like the Fed raises interest rates 25 bips and then stops, but an entire tightening cycle was built into the dollar. And all of a sudden, when you take that support away, people find out that, wait a minute, the Fed is just about to embark on another round of QE. We're nowhere near rate hikes. The bottom's going to drop out quickly. Gold prices are going to pick up. And then I think you mentioned about the shortage. Look, we can have huge shortages of physical metal, which means that, you know, let's say the price of gold goes up to $1,300, but there's no physical supply, and we have to mark up our coins 10% above spot or something because there's just so much demand and not enough supply. So, you know, if you're thinking about buying more gold or silver, I would hurry up and do it, because not only might you see higher prices in the immediate future, but you can see much higher premiums to actually get the physical gold. So I would get it now before that situation, gets even more dire.
Exactly. And what is your real risk on the downside? So even if it were to drop, let's say, from around $10 or $1,100 to $800, you might be risking in the neighborhood of 20-25% on your investment, whereas virtually everywhere else, you're risking as much as 100%.
I think, though, the odds of gold going to 800 are so slim, because they couldn't even get gold below 1,000 when everybody thought the Fed was about to raise rates. Now that most people think now they're not going to raise rates, why would gold go down now? So I think your downside now is really limited. I doubt we'll see gold back below 1,100 if it even can get below 1,150.
I think you're approaching fire sale levels. Ask yourself, what's your risk to reward ratio here? And of course, if you can't stomach the margin, then don't get involved in the margin, and anything you have can be hypothecated without your consent. Is 2016 going to be the year for the precious metals bulls?
Well, you know, it's been a long time in coming, and certainly it's starting to look that way, right? It's starting to look that 2015 is going to finish strong, and everybody was looking for gold to be down in 2015, and it's probably going to finish 2015 in the black, and that might not even be the case for the stock market. There's a good chance that Dow Jones is going to end the year lower than it began. The gold, that brick, that paperweight, will probably outperform the U.S. stock market in 2015, but then it's going to leave it in the dust, I think, in 2016, because we have so much catching up to do. And I think what's going to surprise the heck out of people is how fast the price of gold goes up. You know, because I think it's going to go up a lot faster than it went down, because it's really reflecting the movement in the dollar, which is going to go down a lot quicker than it went up. And that's the case. This dollar rally has been slowly building for years, and it's going to evaporate in months. And the flip side of that is going to be the rise in the price of gold.
And get as many of those paperweights as possible. As we wrap up here, I know that you follow the real estate markets. You're one of our few guests who really has his finger on the pulse of the real estate sector and housing. So I'd like to know what you make of Wells Fargo's latest mortgage application number. You know, they're showing almost 40%. That's the biggest percentage drop since 2009. You're talking almost 6 years.
Because what happened was the government was changing some rules, and so everybody was rushing to get their applications in prior to the rule change, so that we've just pulled forward a bunch of mortgages. But I do think that the housing market is in trouble. I think this is another bubble, you know, where they have reflated the same bubble, but it's different in that, you know, the home ownership rate is the lowest it's been in almost 50 years, because a lot of Americans were wiped out in the last bubble, and so now they're renting from the hedge funds that bought their houses out from under them. But, you know, if you look at affordability, houses have never been so unaffordable in America, and that's despite 3.5% guaranteed down payments by the government and artificially low interest rates. So the housing market has a long way to fall. I think the Fed wants to prevent that from happening, and the only way to do that is to keep printing money, and unfortunately that's what they're going to do, and they may stop real estate prices from collapsing, but they will cause gold prices to surge. And so in terms of gold, right, real estate is really going to get killed. I mean, yes, the Fed can stop house prices from going down in dollars, because they can print dollars faster than you build houses, but they can't stop the price of houses plunging in terms of gold. So I think rather than buying a house right now, people should buy more gold. And in 5 years, you'll be able to buy a lot of house, a few ounces of your gold.
With all of the hedge funds and institutions buying up foreclosures and the rest of the last 5, 6, 7 years, I mean, that inventory at some point, pseudo shadow inventory, I mean, it's going to hit the market.
Oh, yeah. Who are these hedge funds going to sell to when their investors need their money back? And they say, well, all your money is tied up in these houses. Well, sell them. Well, sell them to who? You know, the initial idea behind these, you know, funds was buy up the houses when they're cheap, and then they were, the exit strategy was turn around and sell them back to the renters. Well, the renters are broke. The renters can barely afford to rent down payment on a mortgage to buy the property. So I think this is going to be a disaster for these private equity guys, and it's going to obliterate the housing market, because this is a big deal. When the housing market went down before, everybody had mortgages. So when you were underwater on your mortgage, you really couldn't sell. You needed permission from the bank to do a short sale. And so a lot of houses didn't get sold. But these hedge funds don't have any mortgages, so there's nothing to prevent them from selling. And, you know, these guys are used to taking a loss on a trade. You know, you buy a stock, it's down 20 or 30%, it doesn't work out, you blow out of it and go on to something else. So they're going to think nothing of selling these houses for 20, 30% losses. So they're going to obliterate the market. And they don't even live in the houses. You know, if you live in your house, you know, you're maybe not as likely to sell it because now you got to move. But if you don't even live in the house, if you just bought it like a stock, you just bought it as an investment, and if it turns out it didn't work out, well, just cut and run. So this market could see selling like we've never seen, and I think that scares the daylights out of the Fed, which is, you know, why the last thing on its mind is a rate hike.
Because don't you see, we see the housing market priced for perfection, and we have the precious metals market priced for utter destruction as a result of interest rates. But I think what's happened is the markets, and I don't like to say this, may have it wrong to discount gold to nothing and housing to perfection when they both hinge so heavily on interest rates. And that's where I think that's the Achilles heel. The FOMC goes all in on rates. You're going to see a bottom in precious metals, and you'll see housing roll over for good.
Yeah, and where you can really see it more is in the housing, not the gold stocks. I mean, that's where they've discounted it to ridiculous levels. You know, look at these gold stocks. I mean, you can buy gold stocks today for half of what they were trading for 15 years ago when gold was at $275 an ounce. It's now at $1,175 an ounce. So that's how ridiculous Wall Street is. So that's where the real bargains are. You know, we also, in addition to physical gold that we sell at Euro Pacific Gold, we also deal in gold stocks. I think you've got some incredible buys. I also manage a fund with Adrian Day, the Euro Pacific Gold Fund, which I think is a great way people could participate in this bull market in gold stocks, so people can, you know, get a prospectus and make sure they understand all the risks, you know, inherent to investing in gold stocks. But there's also some tremendous opportunity right now because these stocks are so cheap, in my opinion, that if you really want to speculate on something, I can't think of a better speculation than gold mining stocks.
Well, didn't we just find that out last week with the XAU up 14% in 1 week? And you're talking about the majors. We saw GG, Newmont, Goldcorp all up 10-11%, you know, in just 1 week.
Goldcorp is up 7.5% today. You know, and it's still, the day is only half over. But this is not even a big move. I think when gold really takes off, in fact, I looked at this chart. For gold to get back to where it was at its low point 2 years ago, right, the lowest point it hit 2 years ago, gold only has to rally 7.5% or so to get back to that low level. But gold stocks have to rally over 50% from here, right, to get back to their low point from 2 years ago. Their low point. Like, not like, you know, their high point, the lowest they got. That's how cheap these stocks are. Think about that. Potential 7% rise in the price of gold, 50% or more rise in the price of gold stocks. I mean, talk about leverage. You know, that's, you don't even have to borrow money. You just buy the stocks for cash, but you've got so much built-in, you know, leverage to the price of gold because nobody believes this rally. And even though we've had this significant rally, these stock prices, these gold stock prices really don't reflect it at all. Because nobody believes it yet. Everybody is standing there in disbelief. You know, they're like, you know, like the deer in the headlight. Doesn't want to believe what's about to happen. But that's, I think, the position of the guys who are short these gold stocks.
Okay, so as we wrap up here today, give folks an idea more about the services you provided, Shift Gold and related websites, and any other services you'd like to share with us, please.
Well, Shift Gold is my precious metals company. If you want to get physical gold and silver before we run out, you know, go to shiftgold.com or call one of the representatives and get your physical gold and silver. And we market up. We have some of the lowest prices that you'll find, even on the internet, where there's no human interaction. We have actual people that will help you, and we're cheaper than most online gold and silver dealers. So Shift Gold. And then, again, if you want to take advantage of mining stocks and foreign stocks in general, just to get out of the dollar, you don't have to have everything in gold stocks. You want to diversify. You want to own other stocks in Switzerland and Singapore and New Zealand, some of my favorite countries to invest in. Talk to the brokers at Euro Pacific Capital. It's europac.com, EUROPAC.com. And then don't forget to follow me on Twitter and YouTube and Facebook, and listen to my video blogs at Shift Radio and my podcast, rather, on Shift Radio. In fact, I'm going to be doing another podcast later today. So look out for that, you know, Shift Radio, and also my video blogs on my YouTube channel. There's a lot of stuff. My books are out there. My most recent one, again, The Real Crash, America's Coming Bankruptcy, How to Save Yourself and Your Country. We've got a revised edition with over 100 new pages. So you can pick that up Amazon or at my bookstore. We have a bookstore at Shift Radio.
Peter Schiff, thanks so much. We'll look forward to having you back on the show.
Hey, anytime. Have a good day.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Sometimes you just have to take in stride the audacity and in-your-face bluff of the linguistic terminology used to both sell and cancel out objections of official Fed policy when presented in soundbites and headlines. Federal Reserve Chairman Stanley Fisher recently commented that a 2015 U.S. rate rise is an expectation and not a commitment. In other words, it is and it isn't at the same time. Drilling down, what he's really saying is that nothing that is implied as imminent, like raising interest rates, is factual. It's just a head game and a perpetual head fake of implications. At an IMF meeting in Peru, Fisher commented that both the timing of the first rate increase and any subsequent adjustments to the federal funds rate target will depend critically on future developments in the economy, and that what he called considerable uncertainties surrounded the U.S. economy, which include a decline in exports from slowing global growth, less investment from low oil prices, and the recent drop in U.S. job growth. And here's where the artful doublespeak continues. On one hand, Fisher said the U.S. economy was generating enough jobs to make progress towards the Fed's goal of maximum employment, and inflation would eventually rise. He suggested the Fed should be able to maintain an initial rate hike expected in October or December. But on the other hand, Fisher indicated the U.S. is more exposed now to international events and global developments in China and other countries, which influenced the Fed to delay September's rate increase. I can guarantee you the expected October and December rate hikes will be non-existent as well. This artful game of doublespeak, where something is and isn't at the same time, has now been adopted by Republican candidate Donald Trump, who has suggested interest rates should be higher, but also stated there would be dire consequences when they are raised. Donald is missing the point. They cannot raise interest rates with the current debt, under the current system, without killing that system and most within it. He knows most either don't understand or acknowledge that critical point, which allows him to make a political argument that will bypass the critical awareness of those who prefer political pandering to economic fact, when he says things like, Janet Yellen, for political reasons, is keeping the interest rate so low that the next guy or person who takes over as president could have a real problem. Trump went on to say, they are trying to put the next recession, it could be a beauty, into the next administration, and that's not fair. What's not fair are the continual lies, misrepresentations, sophisticated doublespeak, and pandering that politics and economics have become. There is no escape from this slow-motion economic nightmare we are all a part of, which will pick up speed without warning and impact everyone once again. Chris, I'd like to urge all of our listeners to sign up for my email list at conquerchange.com. Several years ago, I hosted a series of teleseminars on gold and the economy, and will soon begin hosting a series of free Conquer Change webinars. And if any of our listeners are ever involved in bringing in keynote speakers or entertainment for their companies or professional organizations, please visit my companion website at robertian.com. And until next time, this is Robert Ian, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at Conquer Change. Thanks, Chris.
H.S. Dent Jr., editor of the free newsletter Survive and Prosper, H.S. Dent Forecast Newsletter offers current analysis of economic, financial, and market trends, also author of several bestsellers, so it's a pleasure to have him back here on the show. Welcome back, Harry S. Dent Jr.
Nice to be back, Chris.
Investors weren't terribly pleased with the FOMC's decision to hold rates steady, although most of us had anticipated it. They had been talking about at least a quarter point rate hike at the recent meeting, and now if we look at the implied volatilities in the 30-day Fed funds futures rate, we're not going to have a rate hike at the end of October either. Are they trying to manage, you know, micromanage or macromanage, I guess it is, China, you know, the economic slowdown over there and in Europe? You know, are they concerned that there might be a contagion into the domestic economy?
Yeah, well, you know, Chris, I've been saying the whole year that they would not raise rates this year. They intend to because it'd be the right thing to do. But, you know, we keep seeing weakness around the world. I've been forecasting for years now that commodity prices are collapsing because of the slowing of China. This hits emerging markets, and it's hitting the whole kind of global growth and trade picture, and that's why they didn't move. Now, the Fed keeps saying, oh, we're just looking at the U.S. We don't, you know, manage the world. Oh, no, they balked because of weakness overseas. And again, I don't see a raise in December because I think the stock market's going to be lower in the next couple weeks, and that's going to give them more cause to be cautious.
You know, we've had nothing but a sell-off since the FOMC meeting, downtrend that we've seen following the first hour after the meeting. It's been nothing but down since then. So obviously, it's not what people were expecting. I mean, frankly, the Fed were very confident if the recession was over and our fears, you know, regarding an economic pullback or downturn had passed, that they would certainly pull the trigger on rates because of fears of inflation. And they didn't do that, and they're not going to do it in October, 91% confident of that, even more so than the last meeting. Do you think they really are trapped here? I mean, as many of our guests have said, and they're just not going to be able to pull the trigger on rates at all.
Yeah, I think they are trapped. They're not getting... Another reason they didn't raise rates is that inflation has not come up to their 2% targets. Inflation just keeps not happening because of the broader deflationary trends after the greatest debt bubble in history. And debt bubbles are always followed by deflation. And frankly, that's one of the reasons gold keeps trying to rally, and it should rally here. Gold likes to see inflation. And until we see some inflation, the Fed's not going to raise rates, and you know, we're not going to see this kind of rally in gold and other things that people expect, including me. So it's very unusual here what's happening, but it's because there's a broader deflationary environment. That's why the Fed and the central banks around the world have been printing money nonstop since 2008, because they're fighting deflation with inflation, and they're not succeeding. They can't get, even Japan can't get inflation to come up with three times the stimulus we had. Very unusual. People need to understand that deflation is the trend.
But I think it's important because these themes, these trends are central to, you know, making wise investment choices and positioning one's portfolio, you know, in the best and most profitable direction on a forward basis. And it really caught almost every money manager off guard. You know, they all get on this risk off trade, the long only trade. I mean, even hedge funds, which the prime directive, if you will, was to get rid of risk, to hedge away risk. And they didn't. They said, you know, I'm going to keep up with my colleagues. And so everybody gets heavy on one side of the trade. You're not convinced that trend is going to continue. You think we could see more pain in the equities markets?
Oh, yeah. Chris, I see this as the first wave down of three major crashes that are going to happen over the next year and a half or so. And I think this wave down is not finished. We're bouncing a little bit off the last little mini crash, but I think we're going to go down into mid-October, somewhere between 14,000 and 15,000 on the Dow, roughly. So another mini crash, and then we'll probably rally into year end. But that'll just be the first wave down, you know, 20% or so in stocks. And then we'll see, I think, the biggest wave down in the first half of 2016, and then a final wave down into late 2016, early 2017. Most crashes happen that way. You know, there's three major waves down and then bounces in between. And the bounces can be strong. So the good news for people that have been caught in this and said, oh, I didn't think the stock market could go this far down, well, wait for the next bounce, maybe into November or December. It could be substantial. And then bounces in the market in stocks is a way to get out, because stocks are going to get hit the hardest here because they are the ultimate risk-on trade that is going to fail after the greatest bubble in history.
I just want to qualify here, bigger believer in reducing exposure, but not completely eliminating any asset class from the portfolio, because in the final analysis, very few people know exactly what's going to happen. And timing the market is not something I want to promote too strongly. But I do want to keep up with an important theme, you know, you've covered in the past, the commodities market. And dollar strength continues for the most part. It's taken a pause here over the last several months. Do you see further pain ahead in commodities? And also, we'd like your views on black gold.
Commodities, by our thing, it's a very clear 30-year cycle. We've been warning for years that commodities were going to peak, and people keep telling me, Harry, you don't know about the growing middle class in the emerging world. And I said, look, I understand that, but the emerging world gets hit harder when we go down, the developed world. And China has been slowing, and they've been the biggest consumer of commodities. So commodities are going down, and we don't see this cycle bottoming until like the early 2020s. That's many years from now, although I think we've seen the worst of it. I mean, iron ore is down over 70%, and coal and oil and all these things. I see oil going to $10 to $20 a barrel before it bottoms. And I think we're going to see $30 to $32 in the months ahead. But ultimately, $10 to $20 a barrel, it's not going to stay there. That's just going to be a bottom. But I see oil in the kind of $20 to $60 range for the next several years. And so that's going to kill all these frackers and the tar sands producers in Canada. And that's exactly what Saudi Arabia wants. They're the low-cost producer at $7 a barrel. We're 55 to 80 here with the frackers. And everybody thought the fracking thing was a revolution, was going to make U.S. independent of oil and all this sort of stuff. It was just a bubble. It only happened because junk bond rates went down to 5 to 6%. Now they're at 8. Next thing you know, they're going to be 10, 15, 20%. And oil prices shot from $32 to $115 just because of global stimulus by central banks.
You know, that's interesting because that would just decimate the upper Midwest.
And Texas, the strongest state in the country. People don't realize that Texas had a recession and a real estate crash in the early to mid-80s because oil dropped, you know, like 70%.
Keep in mind, they also used incredible derivatives in that housing boom there. And I think they learned their lesson. For instance, Houston didn't suffer during the recent housing crash, one of the few major cities to walk away unscathed. But yeah, your point is well made, because the fracking business carried the whole middle section of the economy there through the last 6-7 years. Move on to another important part of the financial puzzle, and that's the housing market. The echo boom, quite a remarkable rebound. If we look at it just statistically or on a chart, certainly had a 50% retracement from peak to trough. Nevertheless, we're starting to see some cracks in the foundations. More specifically, seems like almost every important component, anything that could really sustain the market for the long haul, is starting to get a bit thin. For instance, the Fed is obviously going to stop at some point holding rates low. At least that seems to be their mandate. Plus, we're seeing considerably lower disposable income for the median home here. It's about $5,000 or $6,000 less than in 2007-2008. And there's one other interesting aspect. From a technical perspective, there is a massive diamond in the Philadelphia HGX housing market. This preceded the recent crash in the S&P 500. Give us an idea of what you see in housing.
Yeah, I mean, from my view, housing started a major long-term downturn after the baby boomers were done buying, which is a predictable thing. And the younger generation cannot get loans easily, do not have the same job prospects, and have student loans. So housing started to go down, but the Fed interrupted it with QE 1, 2, 3 plus. So I think housing has bounced back. It's not to new highs in most areas. It's going to go down lower than before in the next several years. So housing, real estate, I think, is going to go back down at least to where the bubble started in January of 2000. And that is 40, 50% lower on average, and way lower in some areas like Miami or San Francisco or Manhattan. And everybody thinks you can't lose money buying a $20 million condo.
You've given us a pretty solid overview. I mean, you haven't really been too specific on gold, but obviously you don't see inflation without inflation, expecting deflation still. Interestingly, as we mentioned, Jim Rogers agrees with you. He thinks the dollar will remain strong despite everyone's contention to the opposite. And he thinks that once that peaks out, that's when he's going all in on the precious metals again in the next few years. Any other comments? I mean, for instance, do you think maybe the gold mining sector, the selling there is overdone? It's certainly been a favorite theme recently.
Well, there's no question that gold and gold miners are oversold and they're due for a bounce. But I think the bounce may be more back to 1200 or something on gold. And then it goes down because of the deflation trade. And I agree with Jim Rogers. I'm bullish on the U.S. dollar, but I'm only bullish into around early to mid-2017. I think once the dollar catches up with other currencies, it's been down since 1985, then I would be neutral or slightly bearish on the dollar. So this dollar rally is not going to last forever, but it is going to continue to hit commodities on top of the slowing of China and the emerging world because of commodities collapsing. And China, people say China's growing at 7%. There's no way that they could be growing at 7%. Their statistics are inflated. I think China's growing more at 3.5 to 4%, and they're going to go into the deepest recession we've ever seen in the world. So commodities are going to get hit by China more than anything else. And so you have to wait for the China crash to happen and then reevaluate. And I think when that happens, the dollar will go up as the safe haven in the world. But after that, I'm not bullish long term on the U.S. dollar because we'll never be what we were in the past decades. But we are the safe haven in this downturn. And I do think the worst of the downturn is going to happen in the next year and a half or two. And so I'll reevaluate gold and the U.S. dollar maybe a year and a half, 2 years from now. But for now, it looks like gold is more down after a rally. It still deserves a rally here. I would use a rally in gold to get out. But when gold does finally go down and find its bottom, in the long term, we're going to have the biggest commodities boom in history for decades to follow, because the emerging world is going to generate all the growth, and they are commodity and gold intensive. Indians and Chinese buy more gold than anybody.
So let's talk about, as we wrap up here, the BRICS nations and the potential energy that you see there. Continued sluggishness in China, which has sort of been poised to surpass the United States as the world's largest economy. I'd like to hear your demographic assessment of China.
Well, China is the only emerging country. It's the largest next to India, which is going to surpass them in population down the road, but the only emerging country that has a declining workforce since 2012, and it's going to decline for decades ahead. So they're growing on urbanization, and the government is force-feeding it at its steroid rates, and that's why they've overexpanded. They just opened the biggest steel plant ever when they're already 40% over capacity in steel. They're building stuff for nobody. Condos, roads, malls, offices, infrastructures, railways. So China's already expanded enough for their growth for the next decade.
China tends to be ahead of the curve. And so why are their policymakers making this mistake from your perspective?
Because they want to grow. They want to grow, and it's all through a top-down system of communist governments who basically guarantee loans for the smaller local governments, and they give all their contracts to their crony partners in business to build stuff for nobody. China is building infinite stuff for nobody. If a business did that, they would be bankrupt by now. And when you overbuild, what do you get? Deflation, because you've got too much capacity, prices fall to clear the capacity. For the next decade, it's the worst place to be, worst place to put your money. India is going to grow because they're the real deal. They are not as urbanized. They have much better demographics for decades ahead. And when China fails, foreign investors are going to say, oh, what's the next big thing? It's India with 1.4 billion people. They're about equal with China today. They're going to be larger in the future. India is the country of the future. And they're going to decline in the future. China's going to actually decline in population.
A similar playbook is Japan, 80s and 90s. That's it. Once again, this growth pattern seems to continue westward. Go west, California to Japan, Japan to China, and now China to India.
Yeah, Southeast Asia and India are the next growth arenas of the world. So when we do have this crash that I'm forecasting, that's going to be very substantial and last for another 2 to 5 years or so, I want to invest in Southeast in South Asia. That's where everything's going. China's already seen most of their boom, and they've overbuilt. They still have urbanization for a couple of decades, but they've already overbuilt for that. They could never build another condo in China and house all the people coming from rural areas for a decade or two. They have 240 million people in cities that are not even registered people in those cities. They're like illegal immigrants in the United States. They don't have access to health care or education or any of the minimal welfare things there. They are trapped. They have no skills. They've just come off the rice paddies, and they can't even move back to the rice paddies because they paved them over with condos that are empty. The huge potential unrest.
A lot to digest, a lot on the plate. Please tell people more about the services you provide, how they can get in touch with you.
Yeah, you know, the best thing, we have a free daily newsletter that keeps people in touch with what we're thinking. It's at harrydent.com. It's that simple. Go to harrydent.com, put in your email, you're on our newsletter, and we'll keep you updated because we think there are major changes coming in the next few years, major threats and major opportunities.
Thank you. Have a great remainder of the day.
Okay. Thanks, Chris.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Bill Murphy is at the helm of the Gold Antitrust Action Committee. Got it with Chris Powell. It's great to have you back.
Great to be here, Chris. Thank you.
You know, interesting story today. Popped up on the GATA.org website. One of our favorite guests, Dr. Chris Martinson, has recently endorsed the gold manipulation story. And I can tell you, after many conversations with Dr. Martinson, he wouldn't endorse this story if it didn't have some substance. Can you give us maybe an overview of the gold manipulation story? I mean, I think we all could use one again.
Well, basically, Chris Powell and I, my colleague, thought it was just the bullion banks, you know, the Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Deutsche Bank, so on, manipulating the gold price after the long-term capital management blew up, because we could see what they were doing in the market and one story after another. It was obvious that they were preventing the price from going up because it would have created some havoc in the banking system, and the Fed got involved and so on. Initially, we thought it was just the bullion banks. Then we realized it was much bigger, that it was the Fed, the Treasury, the Bank of England, the Bank for International Settlements, and it's all-encompassing. And you know, we've been at this since early 1999, exposing this thing, and I think eventually it's going to be the biggest financial scandal in U.S. history when eventually it leads to a blow-up in the gold market, silver market, too. So we're on the case, have been all this time. It's great to have Chris Martinson on board, and the more the merrier that this travesty gets exposed, because it's going to lead to a lot of other dysfunctional things in U.S. financial markets as time goes on. We're starting to see it now, by the way.
I think it's interesting because the crowd just keeps growing. We don't hear of any defectors. I like how Martinson points out eventually the crowd, they ridicule you, fight you, and then they just say you were lucky, and then finally they accept it. The Argentine real has collapsed. Gold has just skyrocketed, just shy of 100% in a year. I mean, that would put gold north of $2,400. And if this sounds like just an anomaly, it also occurred with the ruble about 6 months ago as well. It's like their pillars, the manipulators, the pillars of their support are tumbling. Maybe it's going to take the U.S. dollar to roll over. Jim Rogers had him on recent weeks. He's just waiting for the moment for the U.S. dollar to peak.
Well, it makes sense. You know, the problem is, I guess, that all the currencies stink right now. But the thing with the dollar, which stands out, it's so overowned by other countries. And that's the difference between a weak currency and the dollar. So when it goes, if people want to get out, there's so many of them all over the world that it would be like a waterfall. And that could create the kind of panic in the gold market in dollar terms, as we've seen in other countries, as you brought up.
Okay, well, let's talk a bit about the Federal Reserve. What an interesting story here. You know, I know a lot of people in the gold crowd, they don't want to hear about it. They don't want to talk about the Fed. Well, there's all kinds of agendas there. In the final analysis, whether or not you think they're leading the herd or they're essentially following rates, it looks like there is a lot of lack of unity. Let's call it that. A lack of unity, a lack of coherence at the Fed. As we saw at the latest FOMC meeting, they didn't move rates higher as they'd promised. Wasn't a big surprise. applies to us because, you know, the Fed funds futures rate said there was a 77% chance they weren't going to raise rates. Now it looks like they won't raise rates in December. So there could be a rate shutout, if you will, for the rest of 2015. What do you think brought about this change of heart at the Fed?
Well, I think the big concern is which is getting a lot of coverage, is the emerging markets, that even a small rate increase could really send them off the edge. So I think, and the Fed mentioned China, of course, and so there's a lot of considerations. But when it comes to the gold price, this whole thing's laughable. If the Fed being at zero for the past 4 years has been nothing but negative for the gold market. So what if it went up 1%, 2%? I know in the 70s, you know, when rates were going up, gold was making its move. It really has nothing to do with it in terms of gold. It has to do with the gold cartel, is that group that I was talking about, and their ability to control the physical markets in gold and silver. And when they start to lose control there, and we think that process is in motion now, albeit slowly, then the gold and silver markets are just going to explode. And it'll probably happen out of nowhere.
We just saw that with the Argentina real. I mean, the currency went vertical. And what I find interesting about it is we here in the United States are in a different situation. We haven't had that hyperinflation for so long, not since you could argue maybe the Civil War. So, you know, we're talking 150 years at least, if not more. So it has left the minds of even our most senior folks here in the United States. We have a heritage of it here in the South, in a region that has grappled with inflation problems and hyperinflation now for decades, if not longer. One would think they would be prepared, but at some point, I guess it could become a problem here as well. All right, let's move on. What do you think could be the tipping point that sends the metal skyward? Have the shorts just run out of ammo? I mean, we're seeing the XAU and the HUI. One wonders how much further they could really fall.
The shares is, everybody knows who's in them, it's just been beyond terrible. I mean, look at Barrick Gold. When we started my website in 98, and God, I mean, Barrick was 17-18, and the other day it had a 5 handle on it. I mean, that is just beyond comprehension. So everybody's pretty much thrown in the towel in all this, and yet I think when it eventually turns, the moves up will just be spectacular. But many in our camp, including myself, could have said that last year, and look where we are. So I do think it will be some kind of black swan event. Other people think like this for good reason, something we haven't thought of. Probably be derivatives related, counterparty risk issues and so on, and then it'll just suddenly feed on itself and it will come upon us very quickly. I think that's what the general population is not prepared for, in terms of the speed that gold and silver are going to move up when they finally take off. Tim, I must say, silver is the worst acting market I've ever seen in 40 years, and it has been for 4.5 years. And every time you think there's a little signs of it changing, it goes right back and acts the way it has been all this time. And many of us are looking for that just to change dramatically, but it just doesn't. You know, what I've been looking at for a while is this open interest in silver, which was about 202,000 a few months ago, and now it's finally come down to about 156,000. I'm hoping it disappears another 20,000 or 30,000, 40,000 contracts. This was at an all-time high a few months ago, and it's just at low prices. It's just ludicrous. I mean, that is just never happens in markets because, you know, there's no reason to hedge when you're way below the cost of production and all that sort of thing. So, I mean, normally open interest would collapse, and it's not been the case, and that's how managed this has been by the paper money crowd, the J.P. Morgans, and so on.
You brought up such an important point, and I think it reminds me of a lot of the reading I've been doing in Nicholas Taleb, Fooled by Randomness, Black Swan, and now Anti-Fragile, where he talks about this interesting concept that markets are incredibly fragile. I mean, more so than like a crystal vase or something. I mean, but unfortunately, we've built up this ideology around the markets. Hedge fund managers and institutions, they're long, primarily long, and even the hedge funds, you know, which are supposed to be about hedging risk, are primarily long only funds nowadays because it works so well for 6 or 7 years. And then what happens? The market, the equities market, blows up out of the blue. Diamond pattern in the weekly charts, and the S&P collapses. I'm beginning to think, after reading his work and seeing the suddenness and abruptness of moves in these markets, if you don't start accumulating through dollar cost averaging now at these levels, even if they drop another 10 or 20%, you're going to likely miss the move move higher because I don't think they're going to sound the alarm this time. You know, back in 2011, you had an opportunity. I mean, we'd been consolidating in an uptrend for several years at that point. I don't know that it's going to happen like that this time. I think there could be a mad dash back to the precious metals, but what else is on the radar screen today?
I think it's we just pretty much covered in the sense of looking to see if our stock markets all of a sudden just really go into a dive mode. And, you know, in the past, we've had these V-bottoms all the time this past year, and now we are not getting that. In other words, all the dips are bought, but they don't go anywhere. Then they come in and the market sold again, and it's constantly getting sold. And a real battering of the stock market here could increase the fear trade for gold and for silver, and that also could be a big catalyst, because what's the Fed going to do for an encore? It could be leading to the kind of talk we've had on your radio show today that you brought up.
If they can't risk raising rates a quarter point, given the supposed robust economic numbers that we've seen here for months, what is it that they're seeing that they're not telling the rest of us? And there's been a lot of conjecture that they're nervous about China, which is maybe entering a recession. Europe has been teetering on a recession, you know, due to the peripheral nation issues. They're going to try to take everything down in this deflationary-like mode, which might even hurt commodities a little bit more. And that is when I think the big guys are going to convert their profits into gold, silver, and black gold. I think black gold is going to regain some strength here in the next few months. Bill Murphy from Gata.org and La Metropole Cafe, could you tell folks more and offer any contact information, please?
Sure, Chris. If people want to take out a 2-week free trial to La Metropole Cafe, they can do so and see if it's of value to them, and then a subscription site. And then my colleague Chris Powell puts out great releases that go to www.gata.org and sign up to be on the list. So it's pretty simple.
Well, we appreciate all you do. Thank you, sir.
And thank you, Chris.
Welcome, John Williams.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Just start off here with developments in recent months since we last had you on the broadcast. You know, we've seen a broad-based rally in the U.S. dollar relative to the euro. How does this factor into your analysis? It certainly would appear, on the one hand, to be at least disinflationary, but my guess is that this is, from your perspective, just an anomaly.
Well, an anomaly would be the way I would view it. Indeed, if the dollar strength continued, it would, I don't know, it would be deflationary, but it certainly would tend to depress inflation rates. The only thing that you have with in the way of deflation or had in recent years was back a couple of years as everything was gyrating following the panic in 2008, and you had oil prices way up and oil prices way down. And if you get a big collapse in oil prices, as we just did, which is also tied to the strength in the dollar, the dollar pretty much drives the oil prices. There's a lot of other factors involving oil prices, but the fact that oil prices right now are low is largely due to the relative strength in the dollar. That brings down gasoline prices. And the gasoline prices are probably as an important factor as you have in the consumer price index, so that in an official reporting, as you had the gasoline prices falling back in, that was 2009, 2010, we had a little bit of official deflation as measured by the consumer price index. However, the consumer price index is some percentage points shy of reality, and I'll contend that if you looked at inflation the way that people used to, that we never really had that shallow deflation. But deflation's not the big issue here, although there are some people that are concerned about a 1930s-style deflation where you had a collapse of the banking system. I think it's going to go the other way, that we're going to have... I'm still looking for a hyperinflation, but coincident with that will be weakness in the dollar, which, again, gets back to your opening question. Let's look at the dollar a minute. Its strength here against the European currencies, the big European currencies, and the yen, is based on several factors that I don't think are going to last and can turn very sharply in terms of market perceptions. Number one is relative economic strength. You look at the rest of the world, it's in recession. You look at our GDP reporting, it looks like we're seeing a booming economy. In fact, the economy that we have seen reported the last two quarters, we're at 4.6% in the third quarter GDP and 4.6 in the second quarter GDP, 3.9% in the third quarter. We haven't seen growth like that since 2003. This is the strongest economy we've seen in a decade, if you can believe the government's numbers. I don't know anyone who's looking at this as the strongest economy in the last decade in terms of real business activity. But that's how silly the GDP number has gotten. If you look at the GDP or the broad economy as, let's say, measured by the revenues, the sales of the S&P 500 companies, and adjusted for CPI inflation and adjusted for stock buybacks, that you're looking at effectively year-to-year sales, aggregate sales net of inflation, the third quarter contracted, and the economy has been flat for a couple of years. That's per the S&P 500. We haven't seen a booming economy there, and you would rarely see a flat revenues in the major corporate America with the economy supported supposedly booming along at decade high levels.
New nominal all-time record highs, 117-year high for the Dow Jones Industrials. In its history, never seen anything near 18,000. You're citing buybacks and mergers and things of that nature being a primary component driving demand and absorbing a lot of the supply of shares. That, of course, is helping to catapult equities to new highs, despite the fact that our economic growth is not nearly as robust as our officials would have us believe. Is that a fair assessment?
I mean, the stock prices are at an all-time high. I've got serious problems with where the stock market is, and I don't have a real happy forecast as to where it's going to go. What I'm talking about are the sales of the large companies that compose the stock indices, the S&P 500. You have 500 companies that make up that index. These are large corporations across the board of industries. And what I'm saying is, if you look at their sales, the level of business activity, the level of business activity is not measured by stock prices. It's measured by revenues, the level of what are you actually selling out there. And if you adjust it for inflation using the government's consumer price index, what you're seeing is that the level of sales of the S&P 500 actually declined in the third quarter. We didn't have an economic surge. We haven't had an economic surge in the sales of the 500 large companies that are in the Standard & Poor's Index. What we've seen is that when you adjust for inflation, their sales level has basically been flat, and it turned down in the third quarter. What I'm saying is that the growth in the economy that's been reported is inconsistent with that. Stock prices are inconsistent with reality as well, and indeed the buybacks do all sorts of things in helping to promote the stock market, as has Fed policy. We can get to the stock market later if you want, but right now what I'm looking at is just a couple of measures of the economy that are suggesting that what we're getting with the GDP is not real. You look at the election, for example. Normally, when pocketbook issues are a big deal, the elections go against the incumbent party in the White House. That's what happened here. If you look at the exit polling as to how people viewed the economy, you had only 26% of the voters indicate that the economy was good or excellent. If you look at that historically, that's consistent with a contracting economy, not a booming economy, an average economy, which would be somewhat shy of 3%. You would have gotten a reading there of about 50%, but down at 26%. And the reality is we're seeing a contracting economy. We're seeing a recession as well as the rest of the world, which is one reason that people begin to recognize that and the numbers turn down in this post-election period. that you're going to see some selling pressure return against the dollar, because relative economic strength is a big factor. And we're in recession. It's demonstrable. People go to my site and look in the upper right-hand corner. There's copies of the hyperinflation report. The second installment shows you how the economics series, the GDP series, have been played with. They use too low a rate of inflation in reporting the GDP, and that has the effect of spiking the GDP growth. You take out the bad inflation adjustments, and you'll find that what the GDP has shown, instead of collapsing into 2009 and then just rebounding, and right now it's just rebounding and expanding, and again expanding at a pace not seen in 10 years, it collapsed and then basically was stagnant and has been bottom bouncing ever since. That's what you see with the Standard & Poor's. That's what you see with the voting indications. That's what you see with the consumer confidence measures. That's what you see with the housing starts. You take look at factors that have inflation taken out of them. You'll see that the economy has not recovered. Second big point with the dollar is related directly to the economy, because the one of the factors here that triggered the early dollar rally, it was a very deliberate effort here, was the a pullback by the Fed in its quantitative easing. Three, it stopped purchasing net new issuance of treasury bills or notes or bonds. It's keeping its levels constant, but it's not increasing them. Well, what you're seeing in the rest of the world is a lot of noise, and the Japanese have actually done some things, a lot of noise out of Europe that, oh, yes, we're going to debase our currency too, and where it looks like all of a sudden the Fed is being unusually prudent, and the rest of the world is debasing their currencies all over the place. That's a good reason for moving into the dollar. My contention is that what's happening with the Fed, it was more orchestrated than anything else for giving us the dollar that we're seeing today. I think part of this is all aimed at putting financial stress on the Russians, a covert economic financial war.
Obviously, crude oil, a huge component of their economic engine, if not the key component. So by having dollar strength, as you alluded to earlier, that, of course, crushes crude oil prices, and we've seen just the biggest decimation since 2008.
As it becomes recognized that our economy is not recovering, not only is not recovering, that it hasn't recovered, or it's heading, that maybe the best we're going to get in the way of the reporting in terms of anything close to accuracy or what people are commonly experiencing will be that the economy is turning down again. Speculation will mount, okay, the Fed's got to come back in and provide liquidity to the system and work to debase the dollar again. That's the big reason that you would see such a shift in the dollar if it looks like the U.S. is in recession again and not booming along. Third area is in the realm of political stability. Big factor if you look at the relative political stability in one country versus another and their currencies. Good measure for that, I found historically, has been the popularity rating of the president, or the positive rating. What we're seeing now is at an all-time low. Normally that would be in an environment where we had a very weak U.S. dollar. You have other factors at play here, too. Our trade deficit is widening again, despite expectations that it would narrow with the lower oil prices. What you have to do from an economic standpoint is look at what's happening with the trade net of inflation. That's how they view the GDP. This will be a negative factor in the fourth quarter GDP because the fourth quarter trade is widening versus the third quarter trade, but it's doing that even before inflation adjustment. Relative trade is a big factor, just basic flow of currencies back and forth with trade. We have a number of factors there that suggest you have a weak dollar ahead. I'm not only looking for a weak dollar, but because the dollar is so far removed from reality at this point that you're going to have a very sharp downside adjustment. There may be currency interventions, all sorts of things that the government will try. what the Fed would need to do if it wanted to fundamentally prop up the dollar would be to raise interest rates. But it's not about to do that because that would kill the stock market and the bond market. So they're back in a conundrum of choices. But bottom line here is that the dollar is going to go lower, and with it, our inflation risks will start to rise rather rapidly. And if you have a panic decline or massive selling of the dollar, as I think will eventually unfold here, you're going to see a very sharp rise in a commodity-based inflation, which will provide a preliminary trigger for the hyperinflation.
Let's talk about interest rates. You alluded to the Fed low intentions of increasing rates because it would eviscerate the housing recovery, that nascent recovery. The Philadelphia Housing Index would likely implode, coinciding with the major equities bull rally. Before we get to stocks and housing, let's talk about the threat of interest rates. Right now, the general consensus, Bloomberg Online and some of the other media outlets, why do you think the FOMC won't raise rates? Or if they do, will it just be a token amount?
They're going to be forced into some kind of an easing again to not help the economy, although that's going to be how it's viewed by the public. It might be to help the stock market, but the primary function of the Fed here is to keep the banking system afloat. And if the economy is not recovering, if it's indeed in recession, new recession, deepening recession, however you want to qualify it, that means more financial stress for the banking system. The Fed's got to provide liquidity to the banking system. That's what it did with its quantitative easing. Its quantitative easing did very little to help the domestic economy. The low interest rates helped the banks to make a lot of risk-free income. But the issue here is whether or not they're going to have to keep funding the banks, and the problem, the answer there is going to be yes. And if you look at the federal government, where the cash deficit was order of magnitude $500 billion last year, that's about what the Federal Reserve actually bought in treasuries in the same period. The Fed actually effectively monetized last year's federal budget deficit. That's a very bad sign. That's very inflationary. That's direct monetization of the debt. That's where eventually you go when the government can no longer raise the funds it needs to cover its obligations. You wouldn't think they were there yet, but you could make a pretty good case that the Fed thought they were there yet, given that they were there now, but given the way they've handled this. But the effect there, assuming they start buying treasuries again, will be to support the treasury. It'll be to support the banking system, not the economy. They know there's nothing they can do, really, that'll help the economy. They've said that. They're very open about it. They use guidelines in terms of, maybe we'll look at this or that if the economy does this. But they can't they cannot take action now that will help the economy. All their bullets have been fired. It's beyond control. So what they'll do, where the economy comes in, is it needing to provide liquidity to the banking system in particular. As the economy weakens, indeed they're going to find ways of putting more liquidity into the system. They're going to blame the economy. The economy is the political cover for them. If they tell the public we're doing this to bail out the banking system, that's not going to be politically popular. But if they say, oh, no, the economy's weak, we've got to do this again, that's an easy sell. So the right now, the Wall Street, the happy story is, oh, the Fed's being virtuous and the economy's so strong, they're going to have to raise interest rates next year. The Fed's going to have to raise interest rates next year because they're so virtuous and the economy's strong. That argument's going to disappear pretty quickly. Are interest rates going to go higher? Yes, they have to, eventually. I mean, it's a matter of the Fed can keep buying up the treasuries and keep rates artificially low, but at some point the markets look at this and again they worry about hyperinflation. They say, where's this going? You just don't want to hold the treasuries, and the only people buying the treasuries that sit on the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee. There will be a process there that will move interest rates higher. Normally, long-term interest rates would write about 3% above the inflation rate to order magnitude. 2%, so long-term interest rate should be up about 5%. Right now, you're still in a situation where you're looking at negative real interest rates at the short end of the curve. It's cheaper for people make more money to go out and buy the goods that are going to be inflated and hold them and make money because those goods are going up in value, than to put their money in a treasury bill, which is still viewed as the risk-free investment vehicle.
When one reviews any of the hyperinflationary episodes throughout history, prices increased at a galloping pace. Many merchants became wealthy, just buying, holding on, and then eventually they were ostracized and vilified and accused of stockpiling against the better interest of society. Do you see something like that on the horizon?
Well, if you're going to have a stable circumstance, possibly, but here again, I think eventually you're going to see that the prices are just going to start taking off, and when they do, the people are going to be more concerned about being able to get product and being able to afford it. You're going to have all sorts of problems with this. But just to finish up with the Fed and inflation rates, higher interest rates are actually better for the economy. This low interest rate spiel is basically a banker's game. Low interest rates kill retired people who like to put their savings in something that's safe where they can get a stable return, like maybe get a CD with 4 or 5% interest rate on it, FDIC insured, or treasury bills that will give you a return that will beat the rate of inflation. When you get retired, you don't want to start putting your money in speculative investments, because that's the only way you can get a return on your money. There's no way you can get a safe return on your money in the United States today because of the Fed's interest rate policies. If interest rates are higher, guess what? Banks then have a little greater a profit margin, and it enables them to make loans with a little higher degree of risk, and they'll lend to people who are a little or less creditworthy, with the effect that it stimulates economic activity. What the Fed's doing with its low interest rates helps the banks. It kills retirees, people who are living on savings, and it actually is detrimental to economic activity. But that's not their concern. Their concern is to keep the banking system afloat.
You know, there's a mountain of notional credit derivatives. Huge component of that has interest rate exposure. Some estimates show higher than $1 quadrillion on a worldwide basis. The deflation camp is quite concerned that within the next few years, deleveraging of much of that debt could have a similar impact on the global economy as the 1930s depression.
What happened in the 1930s was you had a collapse in the banking system. People actually lost their the money they had in the banks. And as that happened, you saw the money supply evaporate. Money supply contracted about a third. Inflation, the deflation was actually down by a third. That all required a collapse in the banking system, a collapse in the money supply. If you have highly leveraged derivatives, the notional values, I mean, you have, that's an extraordinarily high number, but again, in theory, there's not, the exposure is there. Small percentages of that. The fear here would be that it would collapse the banking system. That's where we were back in 2008. Could the banking system collapse? Yeah, it probably could. And if nothing were done, would it have collapsed in 2008? Yep, probably would have. But what you saw happen then was the Fed did everything it could, along with the Treasury. Irrespective of long-term consequence of the action, they guaranteed all deposits. They created whatever money they had to. They bailed out whatever institutions they had to. As long as they can create the money, they can bail out the institutions. The question is what the currency becomes worth as they do all this. They've gotten through the initial 2008 panic without a hyperinflation, and again, they did a number of things to keep the banks afloat without pumping up the money supply as it normally would be pumped up. We're coming up to the second stage of the 2008 collapse. Maybe it'll come in the derivatives. I think it could just happen with the weakness in the system as it still exists. Everything that they did in 2008 to salvage the system, to keep it from collapsing, was temporary. Just push things into the future. The banks are still in trouble. The economy is still in trouble. We get to this next crisis, which could be triggered by the dollar or ongoing weakness in the economy, problems in the derivatives. Speculation as to how they address it. But again, I would expect that the powers that be would do whatever that was in their power to prevent the banking system from collapsing.
Do you talk about how the powers that be and our officials, by using this neo-Keynesian model, they are keeping the economy afloat until a later time when normal or more normal economic conditions return to help support and pull us out of the mire? Things aren't the same, that we're not as economically viable as, let's say, the 1970s or even the early 1980s, that our industrial base has been eviscerated and these methods they're using will no longer have the same panacea-like effect on the economy.
I mean, what you say, I think a lot of people are looking at, yeah, we're just in a holding pattern here till things come back. It's going to be decades before this economy comes back. The economy, there's no basis here for the economy to move forward. And the people in Washington know this. It's a circumstance where what they did back in 2008 was not just buying time. It was, we just got to stop the collapse at this point in time, whatever the cost. They didn't do anything fundamentally to improve the system. They just bought time. They didn't know what to do. It's beyond their control. There's nothing much that they can do to stabilize things, to get the economy growing. I mean, if you look at the economy, the issues here are long-term, and certainly not in a circumstance where you have politicians in Washington either in the White House and or in Congress to look at moving things around. Look at the consumer. Median household income. What's a middle household doing in terms of aggregate income? Adjusted for the government's CPI inflation, not my inflation, which is a bigger amount, would show a weaker economy. But just the headline numbers. You're looking at a situation where income today is below where it was in the late 60s, early 1970s. That's for a household. It had picked up in the late 1990s and then started coming down in the 2000s. And when the was starting to fall off, as the economy was falling off in 2008, but when the economy rebounded in 2009, it just collapsed. That's something that clearly shows that the economy did not recover. You say, what's happening here? The problem is that incomes are not growing as fast as inflation, even the headline inflation. And the reason for that is that a lot of the higher-paying jobs have been lost to offshore competition. Our trade deficit started to balloon back in the 1970s, and as the higher-paying jobs were lost to and the various trade deals, that brought down the average share of the median household incomes, and the consumer just has never recovered. Now, Greenspan, when he was Fed chairman, he came in 87 and helped to trigger the stock market crash by raising interest rates in September of that year, and then as the market crashed, his way of saving the stock market was, aside from intervention by the New York Fed buying stocks the second day, was we'll just abandon the dollar here. Don't worry about the dollar. We'll save stocks. And that's been a common approach. Forget the dollar. Forget the budget deficit. You know, those don't have any political import. And you saw a general debasement of the dollar, a general debasement of the U.S. fiscal circumstance. But as it became obvious that the consumer was suffering more and more in terms of his real income, disposable income, Greenspan realized that there's no way to support an ongoing healthy growth in the economy with the consumer and those trade patterns. And what the Fed did at that time was to encourage people to expand debt. If you can't buy it cover your cost of living with your income because your income is dropping relative to your cost of living, you can make up the difference through debt expansion. Usually the idea is it's temporary, a temporary makeup, but the Fed encouraged debt expansion and debt leverage built upon debt leverage, and that's what gave us the debt bubble coming into 2008. But it also provided most of the growth seen in the economy for the decade before that. As we hit the 2008 panic, the debt collapse, all of a sudden the consumer still didn't have income growth, now couldn't increase his or her debt meaningfully in order to make up for the income shortfall. And the economy continued to fall off as a result. Consumer funds about 72% of economic activity is measured by the GDP. So the consumer doesn't have the ability to expand consumption. There's no way the economy's going to grow. Not going to happen. So there's no big economic boom in the future here unless we get the trade picture turned around, unless you get people making more basic income. A lot of things have to be done to the economy before that would happen. Not going to happen. So what I see happening here very simply is that you're going to have another 2008-like panic. They're going to do whatever they can, but they're not going to get the support of the world in terms of buying the dollar again as they did back in 2008. The dollar will plummet. As the world runs away from the dollar, so will the Americans. You're going to have a tremendous financial crisis here. You're going to end up with the dollar, as we know it, domestically becoming worthless, hyperinflation. So for what investors do, if you live in the United States and your world is denominated in U.S. dollars, you do well to cover at least some of your assets and wealth with physical gold, because the gold will preserve the purchasing power of those assets, get you through the worst of the economic times in a position of having liquidity and having maintained the value of your assets. That's what it's used for here. I mean, the price of gold has been up and down with all sorts of manipulations and with the recent manipulations of the dollar. But I don't care if we get it at $1,000 an ounce, $2,000 an ounce, $5,000 an ounce. When you see the inflation kick in, and the inflation will get worse and worse, you'll see gold at $100,000 an ounce. And there'll be people say, oh, boy, you know, I've made a lot of money here. I'm going to cash out. That's not the purpose of holding the gold. All you've done is you've maintained the purchasing power of the money, the assets that you put into gold. If you liquidate them before the currency system has run its course and the inflation, it'll just become whatever you end up with will become worthless as well if it's dollar denominated from a paper standpoint. It's not a hard asset. So that I look at the precious metals, again, physically holding the precious metals, as the ultimate hedge against the worst of times, against the U.S. dollar, horrible financial circumstances, a way of preserving wealth through difficult times and surviving on the other side of the crisis.
Sure, the listeners would like to hear your thoughts about this equities rally. By some metrics, frothy relative to, let's say, the year 1999-2000, epic where we saw particularly the NASDAQ blow off top. Now we're seeing many components of the Dow Jones, for instance, and the S&P, as well as the NASDAQ and the Russell, almost parabolic and in some cases straight up on weekly and monthly charts. If history is a guide, we see a tendency for prices to revert to the mean.
There's no way we're seeing anything close to a normal economy, financial system, or stock market. What you're seeing in the stock market's been heavily manipulated, played with. I'd avoid it. It's not, I can tell you, I'm not a stock picker analyst. I'm certainly not into day-to-day timing of things. But what I can give you is a rough thing to look at here. The stock market falls into trouble. And you may, I mean, I wouldn't, I'll just give you a scenario that might happen. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but the ultimate thing here is to look at where it ends up. Let's say I'm right on the dollar, and the economy falters. The Fed begins to ease again, possibly to prop up stocks. And certainly, they've done that before to prop up the stock market. So the economy falters, the stocks start to fall off, the dollar weakens, the Fed comes in and it starts to ease again, intensifying the dollar sell-off, but it rallies the stocks. Stocks go to new highs. I would, under that type of a circumstance, I would urge whoever's looking at it to consider the value of those stocks as priced in terms of gold, in terms of Swiss francs, in times of net of U.S. inflation. And I think what you'll find is that the rallies there haven't been rallies when you look at it in constant dollar terms.
But these themes that we see developing in primary markets have a tendency to gain momentum and persist for years, even decades in some cases.
Well, again, that's all tied to the dollar. That's a transitory.
From your perspective, then, this huge shift that we've seen in the last 3 to 4 years will reverse course abruptly and lead us back into a new bull market?
Well, I wouldn't call it a bull market. Again, I'm looking at end times here in terms of the currency system as we know it. I mean, you'll see this happening with anything that right now globally is priced in dollars, such as oil. The dollar sells off sharply. Oil prices in dollar terms is going to rise sharply. That will become very inflationary in the United States. Other dollar-denominated commodities will tend to rise as well. Now, if they're not dollar-denominated, assuming the dollar is selling off here, which I fully expect it will, I mean, that's preconditioned effectively, it'll be even more inflationary in terms of how you see the price. In fact, in the United States, in U.S. dollar terms, prices will be going higher now. But that'll be in something that'll be beyond control. I would not. I'd just batten down the hatches, hang on to my gold, and let the system run its course and crash. I mean, it's not a stable circumstance. I wouldn't want to bet on stability of financial markets, even a domestic distribution of goods and services in a hyperinflation. It's going to be a very unusual times. You can't call exactly what's going to happen. There are all sorts of things that can happen, but I wouldn't be speculating too much in terms of commodity prices or stock prices outside of the basic holdings of stuff that I needed for myself were in terms of commodities such as gold and silver, physically holding the gold. I mean, if you have the someone's holding a gold certificate for you in Chicago and you need the gold because you're going to use it to do whatever, it'd be a lot easier if you had the physical gold in hand than a piece of paper. You don't know what's going to happen within the system. So you want to just be as conservative and as self-sufficient as possible. In fact, I would look at a circumstance here where it probably makes sense to treat what's going to happen to the dollar
as a natural disaster or a man-made disaster. Again, I'm out in California sitting on a major earthquake fault. I'm not here because I want to be here. I mean, I'm with family, and I'm going to get out of this general area from the standpoint of what could happen with a natural disaster. But you have to be prepared. You don't know when it's going to hit. And so people out here stock up with food and water to get them through a certain period of time. If you look at a crisis with the dollar, in terms of the purchasing power of the currency, you might well be in a circumstance where maybe the you're going to have some distribution and distribution disruptions where goods don't get to a grocery store. That's a good way for panics to start. But if you have food and water, the basic necessities that you need to get by for a couple of months, A, you survive, and B, you have barterable goods for what probably would be an interim stage of economic or currency activity before a new system, currency system, was set up. The dollar as we know it, I just don't see surviving. I can't tell you how long it will be before. But if you have, if you're holding gold to get you through the system financially, you need a backup of basic goods that will keep you alive and comfortable as well.
I wonder if you might outline what you see as an end game unfolding with the U.S. dollar. You know, keeping with the earthquake metaphor, do you see a revaluation or a sudden Cyprus moment?
I'm happy to address that general area, but the thing is, you don't know how it's going to break. There are any number of ways it can break. What I can tell you that is a virtual certainty here is that the dollar, as we know it, does not survive, that it will become worthless. There'll be currency crisis, there'll be hyperinflation. How it goes from there, how things go politically. I mean, you get your money out of the bank and the money's not worth anything, it doesn't make any difference.
The FOMC, the Federal Reserve, they're an awfully tenacious group. The Fed has managed to live past 100 years of age. If history is a guide, we'll pull out every stop imaginable just to keep the House of Cards from imploding, keep the music going.
I'm sure they will. And in fact, 100 years, you know, that's almost the amount of purchasing power of the dollar that's disappeared, the Fed was created. I think you're down 98%. But of course, that 2% is what we're living with today. If you'd had your money in gold back in 1914, you'd be in a little better shape. The thing is that yes, they're going to do everything that they can, but they're not magicians. There's certain things that you can do with the system, and certain things that you can't. They came up to the limits there. We had, with everything that was done, particularly since 2004, in the terms of the federal government's obligations, all the Fed has done to keep the banking system, financial system afloat with this extraordinary leverage, build upon leverage, and all these derivative instruments, build upon derivative instruments. There's when you come down to the end, there's a day of reckoning. We had that day of reckoning back in 2008. But they said, no, we're not going to accept this. We're going to do everything we can to keep the system from collapsing. And they did. But there was nothing much they could do to resolve the problems. All they could do is paper over some of them and push them into the future. We're at that future now. We're not far from this breaking open again as a continuation of 2008. But they no longer have all the options that they had. I think what's going to be obvious here is that increasingly the rest of the world is not going to be sitting by and saying, okay, United States, you're going to give me another chance here to work this out over the next 5 to 10 years. The rest of the world's going to start saying, okay, U.S., you're on your own. We're dumping the dollar and we're moving ahead without you. The big problem is the United States and the extraordinary excesses that we've put into it, the system in terms of debt and leverage and fiscal improprieties going into the future, where we have right now net present value of what the government needs in hand today to cover its obligations that it's committed to is $100 trillion, five times the GDP. There's no way that can be covered. eventually, and the rest of the world knows it, the U.S. has to either really get its house in fiscal order, which is not politically possible in the current circumstance, or the dollar is going to become worthless. And it's a matter of when people start bailing out of the dollar. You'd have another 2008 crisis.
There are many investors and traders listening to your voice today. Give people an idea of some of the smoke they should be watching for on the horizon. For instance, you would see signs like the U.S. equities market rolling over, as we saw circa 2007. You'd see the U.S. dollar meandering near a bottom, not breaking out to new highs. So certainly the markets are discounting everything that you have outlined here today. We wouldn't be expecting an implosion by, let's say, 2015.
If the markets were anticipating what I'm outlining today, we'd be in a hyperinflation. They're not discounting it. But forget the U.S. equities. That's really more of a derivative market here to the other factors. The key right now is the U.S. dollar and how it's being viewed by the rest of the world, how it's being held by the U.S. The rest of the world. That's the crux of the issue. But I think you're going to see, rather than a smooth transition here to a weaker dollar, it's going to be some kind of a shock to the system that will create a dollar panic, a massive sell-off in the dollar. It's one that the Fed will probably, most likely, would respond to try and prop it up, most likely with intervention. I don't think they're going to spike interest rates, which would be a traditional defense against a weak currency, because of the other implications that would have for the domestic financial market. Intervention does not have lasting impact. Thing to look at here, what I'm looking for, sharp turn in the dollar, and one that very rapidly evolves into a massive sell-off. And that starts to happen, everything else that I'm talking about will start to fall into place. Again, if things may be done to rally stocks, but I would look at stocks in terms of the real purchasing power. What is it worth in terms of real money such as gold? Are you better holding the gold than the stocks? I have to go back and look at the numbers, but I think you go back to 2000, still did better buying gold than stocks. I'm talking here a long-term perspective, although I'm looking for a very short-term development that puts us in a very awkward situation that gets everything into play.
Oh, no, it's a basic calculation. I mean, gold is 4 to 5 times higher than the year 2000, whereas the Dow is not even 100% higher. Improvement in your assets by just simply holding gold over the past 15 years. So tell folks more about the services that you provide, please, at shadowstats.com.
We have, I put out a newsletter, a weekly commentary. Often there's more than one a week, depending upon economic releases. I assess the numbers as they're released and how they impact the broad picture. We do have also free on the site. That's generally in the upper right-hand column of the homepage. The hyperinflation reports, which detail the basics of what lies ahead, what I'm discussing here. And again, I'm not looking for a near-term happy play in the stock market. I'm looking at survival, and that's what I'm talking about here. This is not a normal, how's the next year going to go? This is when you want to be able to preserve your wealth and assets. That's all discussed here. There's a paper there that explains why the inflation is understated, as the government puts it out. Is it just in normal times? You look at the government's inflation rate and say, oh, that's interesting, inflation's 2%. Most people don't believe that. But if you're, and they're right, if you're looking at an inflation rate that covers the cost of living and maintaining a constant standard of living and reflecting what you're spending out of pocket, that's the way it used to be reported. If you want to have your salary adjusted in a manner that's consistent with maintaining a constant standard of living, if you want to look at an investment return that exceeds inflation on that basis, the problems with the inflation number and where some reality is all discussed there. But again, that's all updated weekly as circumstances change with the newsletter. We're always happy to get new subscribers. It's not very expensive, so if people have a chance to look at it, always welcome to our site. You don't have to put all your assets into gold, but view it as an insurance policy. Same thing with having some goods to keep you going if the grocery store gets shut down.
No, that's such a good point. You know, just-in-time, remote areas in particular, the just-in-time, you know, method that they use to replenish grocery store shelves is certainly an issue. There is no stockpile in the back. It's not feasible anymore. It's not part of their business model. Most companies would go out of business if they kept large inventories on hand. So I think you make a great point. Plus, add in 50 million food stamp debit cards, and you certainly have the potential for a lot of upset and hungry folks on the horizon. John Williams, we want to thank you for your economic insight, sir.
Well, again, thank you for having me on your show.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. The IMF has conveniently given the Fed the perfect cover not to raise interest rates. The fact is, the U.S. cannot withstand an interest rate hike because the majority of its debt is financed on a short-term basis. And despite promises to the contrary of imminent rate hikes at each Fed meeting, we've been getting ready to get ready for that illusory rate hike for nearly a decade in what many like to call a recovering economy. The IMF has reported that higher U.S. interest rates will expose weaknesses in emerging market corporations, which have consumed massive quantities of cheap debt in recent years. The IMF has issued what it calls a double warning over higher U.S. interest rates, which it said could trigger a wave of panic and emerging market corporate defaults in financial markets if liquidity evaporates. In other words, we cannot do anything to jeopardize the punch bowl at the party down the street, or else the unacknowledged punch bowl and party that remains in the U.S. that we are still reliant upon, despite reports to the contrary, will also come to a screeching halt. According to the IMF, corporate debts in emerging markets have increased to $18 trillion, which is up from $4 trillion in 2004, making more companies vulnerable to rising U.S. interest rates. In a pre-released chapter of its latest financial stability report, the IMF warns that as advanced economies normalize monetary policy, emerging markets should prepare for an increase in corporate failures, and that this could spill over to the financial sector and generate a vicious cycle as banks curtail lending. They also indicated the market was prone to what they call sudden evaporation, especially in bond markets, when the Federal Reserve started to raise interest rates. Notice they said when the Fed starts to raise interest rates. I'll say if the Fed starts to raise interest rates, because this report provides another layer of excellent cover and myriad reasons for the Fed not to raise interest rates, because the spillover from other reckless countries could impact the U.S. So we'll just have to bite the bullet and not raise rates, which I believe was never in the cards anyway. The IMF's head of Global Financial Stability Division, Gaston Gallos, said these factors were masking liquidity risks that could trigger violent market swings. He said liquidity is like the oil in an engine. When there's too little of it, the machine starts to stutter. According to a Telegraph article, the IMF said an illusion of abundant liquidity may have encouraged excessive risk-taking by some investors, and that seemingly plentiful market liquidity can suddenly evaporate and lead to systemic financial disruptions. The article posited that banks have scaled back their market-making activities in the wake of the financial crisis, which has reduced their ability to act as a stabilizing force by absorbing excess supply. I remember and actually documented the 2008 crash a bit differently, in that it was the very fact that banks were involved in significant market-making activities that actually helped manifest the crisis in large part. The IMF has now urged European Union policymakers to, quote, reevaluate regulations brought in to restrict transactions on credit default swaps of sovereign debt, which provide insurance against default, but the IMF says has distorted the market. While the IMF said tighter regulation had played a role in tighter liquidity conditions, it said evidence that it would make the next financial crisis worse was still lacking. In other words, the IMF wants to loosen credit standards on a global basis right now. This should be setting off alarm bells with everyone who endured and suffered through 2008. And if you happen to be one of the lucky ones who managed to make it through 2008 without too many scars, there is a possibility you may think I'm putting too much emphasis on these alarm bells. I am not, and time will prove me correct. Chris, I'd like to urge all of our listeners to sign up for my email list at conquerchange.com. Several years ago, I hosted a series of teleseminars on gold and the economy, and will soon begin hosting a series of free Conquer Change webinars. And if any of our listeners are ever involved in bringing in keynote speakers for their companies or professional organizations, please visit my companion website at robertian.com. And until next time, this is Robert Ian, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.